Hello and welcome to 10 by 9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Dorn, and this is the 10 by 9 podcast. Temba 9 has been out and about again, this time to Oma in County Tyrone. It was my first time there for a Temba 9, even though I was born in the town. Long story. Anyway, the evening was sponsored and organised by the Integrated Education Fund, which has been very supportive of us over the years. And it was that oddest of dates, February 29th, and we were in Bogan's Bar for stories of new beginnings.
I've always seen myself as a clown. Had to make them laugh so they'd like me. I've always loved comedy. And it's probably one of the only subjects I can really nerd out about.
Then it all comes flooding back to me. Why I was doing this, who I was doing it for, and how my life had been spiralling out of control, one long drinking binge after another.
Wow, my little girl had flourished into a beautiful young lady. I stopped and stared and said, "Bells, you are beautiful." She smiled from ear to ear.
So we get to hear how comedy helped save one woman, discover how a barman became an Iron Man, and we meet the lovely Ellie. Well, let's get on with it. But just to let you know, I wasn't able to get a feed directly from the mixing desk, so there's a bit more atmospherics than usual, and by that I mean coughs and chair shuffling. But the stories are fab, and all but three of our storytellers on the night were first-timers, which was also great. Here's the first of them, Charlotte Turnbull.
Before I was born, in March 1988, my mother already knew there was something wrong with me. Most of you have probably already figured that out anyway. If I had a sick kidney, which needed removing as an infant, and I was also born without a functioning thyroid gland, it's safe to say a wee bit weird from the start. She has a wee Chernobyl theory, but I'll leave that story for a different day. I messed about a lot in school, yeah. A class clown unanimously in 2006, and I'm actually quite proud of that. I've always seen myself as a clown. Had to make them laugh so they'd like me. I've always loved comedy, and it's probably one of the only subjects I can really nerd out about. Today, laughing would actually be greatly satisfying. Not right now, but we like to laugh in our house, but we don't like making a fool of ourselves. So, when I first started doing stand-up, my mum asked me, "Are you not scared people will laugh?" I said, "I'll be more worried if they don't." My mum's an extremely intelligent mom, but she didn't realise in the moment what she was saying, but I knew what she meant. There's something very satisfying about making a room full of people laugh. When I first started to see comedy regularly in 2009 down in Oster's and then Daly's, it was because I'd had some argument with my parents about probable nonsense and I needed cheering up. It worked, and 15 years later, here we are. I've never really taken myself seriously, as a lot of you will know. That was shown by my A-level results. This led to a mad scramble and clearing to get a place in university because the alternative to me was just unthinkable. I had a ball, and still those were some of the best years, of course, apart from being a parent. In my years of uni in Manchester, although I had a great time, I was a victim of a violent assault, a robbery, and in the final year, a bad mugging that brought me back to Oma after graduation. It also, everything happened for a reason, caused me to lead out my last few semesters as a habitual recluse, which I now thank for the first class honours I ended up with on my dissertation. Like I said, everything happened for a reason. I'm not stupid, I just make terribly bad decisions, which admittedly have provided their own roadblocks. I'd had good job prospects in Manchester, but I had the fear of the city after dark and being mugged again. And I swore I'd just do 1 year at home, and then here I am again, 15 years later. I never moved back, but I do visit now, and I still see it like a home from home, despite what happened. I had a creative burst in my 20s, loads of plays and different healthy hobbies, a good stable job, living with friends, and then flying the nest by myself at a lot of house parties. Plenty of friends, all going great. So where did it all go wrong, like? I'll be honest, I'd always, like most people, done a wee bit of dabbling when I was in uni, but in 2012, at a party, somebody gave me something a bit different. and only took one go before I wanted more. The next 4 years was a train wreck of addiction. We quick moved to Belfast for freedom, because why not throw your great life away? And then I was back to Omagh, tail between my legs, no job, no money, no hope. 2014, I got a flat, and that was the reckoning of me. When I got the flat, they had to tell me the circumstances of what happened before I moved in. The girl previously had been found dead only weeks before from an overdose. I've since been told from my neighbours that they actually expected history to repeat itself when I moved in. Suddenly, the life I was living became more than just a wee drug habit. I was a full-on junkie, having hallucinations of monsters and the works. All my friends started to drop away because, let's be honest, who wants to be friends with a druggie? I thought I was going to die in that flat. I had zero work ethic. I was working a cushy wee job in a shop to pay for drugs. And actually, in that time, I had more jobs than Mr. Ben. In 2015, I met someone who would really show me what toxic meant. And it's only recently that I've actually escaped that person. In 2016, my good friend Shauna reached out to me and gave me the kick up the arse I needed. She took me to McDonald's for a coffee where I confessed everything, got me to a doctor, got me support. And that day, the 16th of June, 2016, I got off everything. 16th of the 6th, 2016. That's a lot of sixes, isn't it? 2 months after coming off drugs, I fell pregnant with my son and was quickly heartbroken that my grandmother died during the pregnancy. But she must have been looking after us, because I never looked back to that life of waking up solely to get a hit and then passing out again. It was a traumatic birth. The look on my mother's face showed me that she thought she was going to lose us both. I still had my dark days. And something a lot of people don't know is that my drug use actually left me some lifelong effects with my speech, short-term memory, and some degree of broken connections. It was in 2019, after 2 failed suicide attempts and 3 days in a voluntary mental health facility, I decided to straight stand up because no F's left to give, basically. I was stuck there over the 12th of July weekend and I felt like one flew over the cuckoo's nest. I couldn't get it out until a doctor came in after the bank holiday, so I hid myself away writing to cope with everything. I didn't get to do much stand-up before COVID hit, which was also responsible for robbing me of the job I'd created doing art in schools, and I seemed to be back to nothing again, and I'm sure most people can relate to that. It was a collectively very difficult time, but yet again, on to the next thing. I've had businesses that have succeeded and failed, but my mental health struggles didn't go away so easily. But like most parents, my son Frankie, who by the way is kind, intelligent and just as sarcastic as his mother, it's my life force and I have to keep going. Finally we're on to the good bit. It's safe to say my life has turned around. In 2022 I joined the gym, started boxing with a school friend, Shane, and I have to mention his gym's just over the road and I told him to give a plug. So, watched myself become strong and confident again with a growing social circle to compare myself to my 20s. Lost a few stone in the process because food had been another coping mechanism. In April 2023, I decided to give comedy another whack. And what an amazing 10 months it's been. I've recently done a workshop with a world famous clown, supported some of the country's top comedians, had both standing ovations and died on my hole. And I now have a quite successful podcast with my fellow comedian, Claire Corrigan, who has been absolutely influential in the turnaround. Thanks to her, I've also recently been in a short comedy film for the BBC, Watch This Space. And I've made steps in being recognised as a comedy writer. I'm writing a panto, painting murals, and as a non-believer of 35 years, I've even started to pray. But most importantly, I'm a better role model for my son. Now, I had this one teacher in school. She told my parents recently that I had brains to burn, and I've nicely added the line, "It's a pity she can't be trusted with matches." I won't name her, but she is actually here tonight, and she knows who she is. Now, I'll be honest, when I was 17, I hated this woman. She told me truths like I'd never heard them before. Of course, it was never anything nasty or vindictive. It was just things I didn't really want to hear. I'm not a genius by any means, but like I said, I'm not stupid. Because of the type of person I am, I took it very, very personally. It was an attack on me. My ego was very, very bruised. And for a long time, I was going to prove her wrong. I didn't, but And then years later, we had a chance encounter via her neighbour. And it turns out that she'd actually had great faith in me all along. I just hadn't had much of myself. Just the other day, I actually invited this lady to come to this event. And she laughed, recalling how I managed to pass an exam without even showing up to the class. And we both had a laugh about how feckin' lazy I was. And that's her words, not mine. I'd like to take this opportunity, as I'm honoured to give this, to have it, to thank everybody who helped me out of these darker times and brought me towards the light. The right people have left my life and the right people have returned. Most important is the chance to apologise and thank my parents. Without their endless love, help and patience, I wouldn't even be on my feet today. So I guess the message here is that even at your lowest ebb, there's always a sliver of hope to change the situation you're in. You don't have to accept your circumstances. Have some faith and you can overcome them. And most importantly, don't give up on yourself.
Thanks so much, Charlotte. What an inspirational story, and best of luck with your comedy and podcasting career. We're always looking for new storytellers at 10x9, so if you'd like to tell your story like Charlotte or our other OMA speakers, then get in touch at the 10x9 website. Even if it's just the beginnings of an idea, I'll do my best to help you bring it all together. Okay, on to our next story, and making his 10x9 debut, here's Patrick McGrath, and just to let you know, there is one small F-bomb.
Tick, tack, tick, tack. With every stroke of my arm through the rippling water, brings me closer to my end goal. Tick, tap, tick, tap. Time isn't really on my side. I've been in the ocean now for what feels like a lifetime and have only started lap 2, which means I have over a mile to go. Thoughts running through my head, I'm out of my depth as another swarmer passes me. Who am I doing an Ironman? And Lanzarote, of all places, one of the hardest Ironman events in the world. I've only been swimming a year, and once I get out of this bloody water, I have a 100-mile cycle over mountains and run a marathon. I'll survive this swim and think about the pints after. Yes, lovely, lovely pints. That's what got me here in the first place, godforsaken pints. Then it all comes flooding back to me. Why I was doing this, who I was doing it for, and how my life had been spiralling out of control, one long drinking binge after another. Time was always on my side, but it's up to me how I delegated it. I might not break any records in completing this event, but this will be the final nail in the coffin of my past life once I cross that line. Tick, tock, tick, tock. I can hear the clock ticking. There's no clock in my bedroom. Where am I? It's roughly 10 years earlier. I peel my eyes open to let them adjust to the surroundings. I've no idea where I am. Have I slept here all night? It looks like daybreak, to be honest. I pull my phone from my pocket. Missed calls and messages I can't really be dealing with. The phone says 10 o'clock. That's all. It looks a lot earlier. It starts to flood back to me. Trickle, memories trickling slightly, and then the river flushes. I was working in the bar. Why the fuck am I drunk? Maybe I had one or two while I was working. I find the courage to read the messages. I stand up, and I'm in the spare room in my folks' house. I always wake up here when I'm too drunk to remember how to get home. I walk out of the room and realise it's not 10 a.m., but it's 10 p.m., I can't remember locking up the bar, or I can't remember locking up, and the bar shouldn't be closed yet anyway. Frantically trying to ring my workmate, can't get through. What to do? I can't drive in because I'm still drunk, obviously. Can't tell my folks, as that'll be the last straw with them. And obviously can't ring my boss. I'm just going to have to sit this one out. But what if the bar isn't locked? My mate finally answers. I can tell by his voice. He's none too happy. He happened to be passing the bar, and the lads there said, I went to the toilet 20 minutes prior and disappeared. Little did they know, I was drunk, walked outside, forgot where I was, forgot what I was meant to be doing, so I jumped into a taxi home. Well, not home, but to my folks' house again. My mate was willing to take the slack for me again and panic over for now. These events, though, were happening all too often, and for the best part, I was getting away scot-free. My drinking was becoming a problem, not for the fact of my love for it, but the confidence it gave me and basically how worthless I felt without it. This started my school days. As a teenager, like most, you know it all. I was living for the weekend because that's when I could break out of my anxious shell. Never had much money, but always scraped enough to get drunk or whatever else we were doing at the weekend. I was as backward as they come, loved sport, but didn't have enough confidence to actually go and play or take part at all. I finally found something I loved and excelled at, drinking lovely pints. I went to uni, drank my way through a 3-year course, only taking 7 years to complete it. Spending most days in old men's bars, drinking cheap pints, loving the crack, and longing for the day when I too would finish up my 9-to-5 office job for the day, head to my local for the evening, few pints, back a few horses, never actually gamble, tell a few stories, what a life that was going to be. I only thought I knew it at 16, but in my 20s now, I definitely knew it. Yeah, right. How was I going to get this office job? Who was going to hire me? Back home from uni, and a year working in the bar, this was the last straw. I had mentally wised up a lot since my younger days, but I couldn't get out of the rut to put it all into practice. And when I drank, I was that young age again. Something drastic was going to have to happen as I was going round in circles. Every weekend was the last weekend. I needed to get out of here. I hopped on a plane to make a new life in Australia. Little did I know, more pain and turmoil, the most I've ever felt, was waiting for me. I'm awoken by a phone ringing. If I ignore it, it'll go away. It doesn't stop. I answer. It's my brother, thinking he's probably looking left home from a night out. I hang up, thinking he can get someone else. I quickly remember I'm not at home anymore, but I'm in Sydney. The phone rings again. I answer to cries from my brother. I can't understand his mumbling. My father takes the phone and breaks the news that would leave a dent in my life forever. My youngest brother had just been killed in a road traffic accident. I was cold and lonely in a faraway place. If I thought the flight there was long, the flight home was the most heart-wrenching journey I've ever experienced. Days, weeks, months of grief passed, and I slowly but surely began to slip back into the life I knew best, but only this time it had a real purpose. Poor me, poor me, poor me another drink, as they say. The only work I could manage to get my hands on was bar work. Midweek drinking became the norm. Sure, I was working all weekend. You couldn't really call it proper drinking. So, of course, I was okay to drink on my days off, Monday to Wednesday. I cried myself to sleep more than I could count. But I was a man of the house, being the eldest son, so I couldn't show this weakness to those who loved me. Instead, I just drank and blurted out tales and tears to anyone at the bar who would listen. I blamed myself for not being there, like it would have somehow magically prevented it. I got agitated when my family questioned my answer and my actions. I didn't have a problem. I honestly knew I didn't. I knew I could stop drinking at the click of a finger, but I didn't want to because it was the easy go-to and I knew nothing else really. I had mustered up the idea of fitness before, ran about 400 metres from the house and threw up, walked back, had a shower and went for a pint. Although I knew I wasn't an alcoholic, the slope was getting deeper, deeper and very, very slippy. Another drunken night at work was the beginning of the end of this chapter to my life. Midweek locking, what could ever go wrong? Let's say, falling asleep at the wrong side of the bar, full drunk, cops landing in and taking me home. To this day, I am grateful that one of the officers was an officer involved in my brother's investigation and may have turned a blind eye. But I wasn't going to put my parents or family or through any more heartache or pain that they were already going through. Feeling sorry for myself wasn't helping anyone, and the answer definitely wasn't at the bottom of any bottle. The not drinking as much wasn't the hard part, but trying to fill that void with something I really enjoyed was going to be the thing that was going to get me through it. I was secret training for ages because, remember, alcohol was the key to my secret power of confidence. Without it, I felt like it was nothing. When I started training, I thought people would have laughed and sneered. What are you going to the gym for? Or what are you doing that for? However, it soon became quite addictive and quite apparent that once I started getting results and beating my own records in the gym and outside it, running, etc., my confidence began to soar. Now, this was real confidence this time, not masked by alcohol. I still do drink from time to time and can enjoy it. As I say, I never felt like I was an alcoholic. I just knew that I was in that rut. I've completed another Ironman since and numerous marathons. I'm grounded now by my coaching business for guys like me who basically lost their way and yearn for an empowerment. I've also got my two kids, Sophia and Olivia, who I want to be a role model for and teach them how to live a truly happy and fulfilled life.
Well done, Patrick, for telling your story and for finishing the Ironman. What an achievement. And as you heard, Patrick runs a health and fitness business, so if you're Noma, you might want to check it out. As I'm sure you all know, 10x9 is always free and always will be, but I just want to say, as always, a big thank you to everyone who has donated via Patreon over the years. There's a link at the 10x9 website if you're interested. And thanks too, of course, to everyone who has given at the live events. You help keep us going, and we really appreciate it. Okay, on to our third and final story on this podcast. It's a wonderful, uplifting story, but just to warn you, it does deal with suicide, so that may not be your cup of tea. Here's the amazing Mandy Chisholm.
Ellie, from a young age, loved to sing and dance. Unfortunately, she wasn't gifted with the voice of an angel. However, she still loved to sing and make up dance routines. Every Christmas from the age of 5, Ellie asked Santa for a pony. I actually thought it was just something she wanted, but the interest grew. Knowing how costly horse riding was, I told Ellie she could have one lesson. This was when she was 10 years old. Well, as you can imagine, it didn't stay at one lesson. And her passion grew stronger and stronger. And the following year, her wish on Santa's list came true. This came as a huge surprise to Ellie. When she received the letter Christmas morning, asking her to sign a contract that she would care for and look after her pony that she had actually been having lessons on. A skewbald called Pinocchio had the hugest nose. Ellie burst into tears of joy. Her wish for so many years became her reality. Ellie was at her happiest when she was with her pony and other horses. I was so proud of her. Ellie was a very caring big sister to Connor. She kept him right when it came to things like being cool in first year of school, secondary school, such as boys don't wear school jumpers. And she put me straight when I sent him to school with a lunch bag. Yeah. Ellie had a good sense of humour and we had many belly laughs. She used to pretend she was taking a photograph of me, but she was actually recording me. This created so many laughs and she caught me every single time. When Ellie became a big sister for a second time to Kian, she said to me, "There you go, Mummy. You have your perfect family." She knew I always wanted 3 children. Ellie was brilliant with him and actually got his first smiles, which I am so lucky to have captured on video. 2 months later, it was Ellie's 16th birthday. We were all getting ready to go out for a meal and I met Ellie just coming out of the bathroom. Wow, my little girl had flourished into a beautiful young lady. I stopped and stared and said, "Bells, you are beautiful." She smiled from ear to ear. We went and enjoyed a family meal, one of many beautiful memories of our time together. 6 weeks later, Ellie went to her final destination, a place I call heaven. My life also went to a final destination, and I had to start a new beginning. 2017, Ellie died by suicide. She had struggled with her mental health from the age of 11 and was actively self-harming from this age. We went to many services, as we do. Some were helpful for us and some just were not for our family. The kind of advice that was given to Ellie was hide everything sharp. Now, what we see as being sharp and somebody who is self-harming is very different. We went to family therapy, which was really, really helpful. But in 2017, Ellie took her own life. Her younger brother, aged 12, got into the house before I did. And unfortunately, he found her. I was carrying Kian, who was 3.5 months old at the time, in his car seat. Our world changed from that moment. At that time, I felt a failure of a mum. And I am going to highlight at that time. Okay. I didn't save my daughter. It was my job to protect her, and I didn't. I went straight into protective mode for Connor, my 12-year-old. I couldn't let him down. I knew that my husband could care for Kian, but I had to protect Connor. And this is where my journey began in educating myself in mental health. At school, I was also a class clown, and everything was just great crack to me at school. So I didn't leave with a big education. So going into mental health myself, not going to colleges and universities and so on, I was invited to an internet awareness evening and a mental wellbeing evening in Ellie's school. And there are many different organisations there, but there was one lady that was on stage and she was talking about hope. Now, initially when she was invited onto the stage, I thought this is going to be religion-based, which is absolutely fine. But the more she spoke, I realised, first of all, it wasn't about religion. And I just sat there and I knew Ellie lost hope for the next day. So I stayed behind and I spoke with the lady, Mary Dunn, very well known in the Trust. And I explained my story and she invited me to do some training. And I thought, you know what it is? I will just go and I will just see what this is like, because I've been to many other things and it just didn't sit well with me. I went and did day one of the training and there was a lady from OMA sat next to me. And she said, do you know, I can't make the second day. My car's in for MOT. I said, well, it's okay. I said, you can get a lift with me. So as the training continued in something that we call theory of hope, towards the end of the day, Mary said, okay, now when we come back, we would like you to deliver a part of the program. Now, I was in a room where it was teachers, social workers, counsellors, and I felt really, really out of my depth. But I'd promised this lady that I'd bring her the next day and I wasn't going to let her down. So after day one, I went to Ellie's resting place. And I said, do you know what, Bells? I'm going to do this for you. And I went to the second day. I completed my training and I went into local schools to deliver mental wellbeing workshops, all based on the theory of hope, and I'll share what that theory is. I go to community centres, sports clubs, parents, because something I found when Ellie was struggling for all those years, all the services focused on Ellie, which absolutely. But we're a family unit in a household. Ellie was my first child. I was navigating parenthood. And during my grief, I became annoyed at the fact that I wasn't signposted anywhere. So I thought, you know what it is? I started doing all my research in mental health, much more into hope, and I created and wrote a program called Hope and Healthy Attachments. I deliver that in local Sure Starts, and I've even been invited into universities. Now, how I got my foot through a university door, I'll never know. But I did, and I've run programs in there for student adult nurses and mental health nurses, because something we all need in life is that glimmer of hope. So what is hope? Well, the theory is it's the belief that the future can be better than the present, along with the belief that you have something inside yourself to make that happen. We all have that little bit of hope. And even listening to the stories this evening, there is hope in there. I do this in Ellie's memory to keep it alive for me. And what I hope more than anything is that Ellie's remembered by the girl that passed on hope far and wide.
Thank you so much, Mandy. You are amazing. And thank you for introducing us to the lovely Ellie. And that's it for this podcast. Check out all the upcoming dates on our website, 10by9.com, and be sure to keep up with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, where I'll keep you up to date with any news. Thank you so much, Oma, for a wonderful evening. Hopefully, unlike February 29th, it won't be 4 years before we're back. Big thanks to Martin, the sound man, everyone at Bogans, but especially Will, who was behind the bar, also the Integrated Education Fund, and Jessica and Gareth, who helped recruit some of the storytellers. Thanks to the amazing and supportive audience that night, and thanks, of course, to all our storytellers. But the biggest thanks this week goes to Charlotte Turnbull, Patrick McGrath, and Mandy Chisholm. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.